FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'll be joined by my co-host Melissa Figueroa this hour. Susie Leisman remains away on assignment, but will be back next week. So this is the third consecutive week in which we have a Beneath the Surface installment of The People's Game, KPFK's show that focuses on the 2026 Men's World Cup Soccer Tournament, the largest and most popular spectacle in the world, and we focus on not only the games on the field, but the political and social subtext of this most massive tournament. And on today's show, we're going to be joined by our co-host and co-producer, Fernando Romero. Lucky Fernando has been in Mexico for the past few weeks and has been there for all three of El Tri's games, and Mexico is in a euphoric state of national carnival, as El Tri has won all three games, and seems almost everybody in the country is absolutely delighted about that. Fernando will report from Mexico City. And then we'll be joined by Laurent Dubois. Laurent Dubois is one of our favorite guests on The People's Game over the years, and he is the John L. Now III Bicentennial Professor in the History and Principles of Democracy at the University of Virginia. He's written seven books, award-winning books, including the incredible book Soccer Empire, The World Cup, and The Future of France, and The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And he is really one of the great radical commentators on the sport around the world. And he will join us from Italy, and he will talk about the French national team, about which he has written the book Soccer Empire, and also about how he sees the entire political subtext of the tournament playing out, as well as the contest on the field. All that and more on today's Beneath the Surface, a People's Game installment.
Welcome to The People's Game. I am your co-host, Melissa Figueroa. I'm here with my co-hosts, Alan Minsky and Fernando Romero, who is still in Mexico City. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Melissa. Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Fernando, how is it looking down in the country that is actually giving the World Cup experience the way that it has been?
Thank you, Melissa, and thank you, Alan. Yes, I'm still here in Mexico City, and I had the privilege to watch the game that Mexico played against Czechia a few days ago here in Mexico City, and it was just an amazing atmosphere. I had the chance to see the game at a local bar here in Mexico City, and yeah, the atmosphere leading up to it was amazing. People, the whole city, you could see it, you know, day of at 9, 10 in the morning. Everybody in Mexico City was wearing their Mexico jersey, and you could just feel the excitement of what was about to happen that day. And yeah, the game was just incredible. We got to see Memo Ochoa take the field for a few minutes, and I think when Memo took the field, I think you felt like the city was about to implode. And I think Mexico played an amazing game. They, you know, they had a couple of substitutes that came in on the starting lineup, including Memo Martinez, you know, sitting down Raul Jimenez. And one thing that really stands out about the match is just the versatility of the team and the unity of the team. I think I may be wrong on this, but I think Mexico, the national team, has officially played all 26 players for a few minutes in the first three games, which really shows the unity of the team, the versatility. And I think also just talking about the fact that, you know, this team doesn't have a lot of stars. I think the biggest well-known name is Raul Jimenez, but the fact that we can, you know, supplement Raul Jimenez with other players and a couple other folks that sat down really shows the strength of the squad from, you know, number 1 through 26. So it was just an amazing game. That goal by Mateo Chavez is one of the most beautiful goals we've seen thus far in the World Cup. And the game was just amazing. It was, we had a chance to celebrate after the match. We walked to Reforma, to Ángel de Independencia, to celebrate with the folks. And, you know, it took us, you know, about an hour just to get to the front of the celebrations. But the city was just complete pandemonium. It was organized chaos, and it was raining. It was pouring hard, and people were still out, you know, men, women, children, elderly folks just celebrating. It was just really As a Mexican national, it's just really beautiful to see so many happy people out in the streets. It was just top to finish, one of the greatest nights thus far in my time here in Mexico City.
It's amazing. Mexico is one of the only two undefeated teams, the other being France in this tournament so far. And what's the sense, the hope that this team can go deeper into the tournament than the round of 16? Now, famously, Mexico has only ever qualified for the quarterfinals the two previous times Mexico hosted the tournament. And what's the sense of how far this team can go?
I think people are believing, and you've seen the memes, the hashtag ECC, like what if, that believe, and you're seeing and you're hearing it everywhere. So I think there's definitely, obviously, to get through the round of 16, there's still two more matches, but right now I think people are definitely believing we can get to the round of eight. I think that's definitely the goal, and I think my opinion is that if we get through to the round of eight, the quarterfinals, anything can happen. And if that's the case, then, like I said, this country is going to be partying for quite a few more weeks and celebrating. And it's good to see that here in Mexico, that the people are out on the streets and enjoying themselves, and definitely giving that perspective what it means to be in the World Cup and to have a good performances in the World Cup for a country like this.
Understanding is, as the home team, they'll be guaranteed to play within Mexico through the quarters. Is that correct? If they keep winning?
Through the round of 16, the round of quarters would be in the U.S., to my understanding. So, and like I said, if they get through the round of 16 into the quarterfinals, like I said, anything can happen. And if Mexico has to play in the U.S., that feeling of home field advantage will be felt anywhere in the U.S., whether it's New York, Seattle, Kansas City, Miami, Mexicans will show up. And so it'll be exciting.
Oh, you didn't hear about the new Fargo, North Dakota location they've developed in the United States?
No, I've not heard about it.
You will still be back with Mexican fans. Just go ahead and listen. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. We spoke on in our previous episode to Gustavo Arellano and Hugo Villalba in Los Angeles, and Southern California is just the same. It's hopping. Everybody's excited about Mexico. One of the great things about this last game was that, you not only had the elder statesman of El Tri, Memo Ochoa, but also the rising star, right, in Mora. So it was like this great kind of bookending of the grand old tradition and the upcoming thing. And that was just so special.
Well, if you don't mind, one thing I'll say about the team is this past game is that they scored three goals. And one thing that people have been saying is that this team needs more offensive power. So that was really beautiful to see heading into the round of 32, because they're definitely going to need that. And, the fact that the team went, had blank sheets the three games, it's wonderful. And we know Mexico has an amazing defense, an amazing goalkeeper, but definitely that goal scoring prowess is going to be needed moving forward. And that's definitely showed in this previous game.
Yeah, and as we speak right now, we're speaking before the Saturday games, which are the final set of group matches. By the way, tomorrow, Sunday, is the sort of slowest day of the entire World Cup so far, and for a while, because it only has one match, which will be South Africa versus Canada here in Los Angeles. And then we go back to multiple matches each day on Monday. But for today, at the end of the day, we'll know all of the round of 32 matches. And it's a real mystery to figure out who Mexico could play, because they're supposed to play one of the third place teams that gets through. And England is favored to win their group today by beating Panama. And if they do, they'll be in a similar situation with Mexico against a third place team. And if they win over that third place team and Mexico wins at home over a third place team, then they would face off in Azteca, England versus Mexico. And given the preeminence of the premiership right now, obviously it's understandable to think that England has sort of the team is as well known in its players as any team in the tournament. And that's sort of new for England, but with the premiership now really sort of globally having a bigger audience share than any other league in the world, that's a new phenomenon. But they're very well known, and they're very closely followed. That's going to be an epic, operatic match. And one thing I wanted to ask about, Fernando, and this is something that Mel and I go back and forth on, to what degree in Mexico is there a sense that the game was invented there? Because obviously the English claim club football, federation football, as having been founded in England. But we know soccer-type games were played around the world And to what extent is there a sense of ownership of the game in that respect in Mexico? Will it be a, besides the high operatic question of in Azteca, can England be defeated so that Mexico go famously past the round of 16? It's obviously a massive global spectacle just on that order. What sense is there that they maybe are the two of the founding countries of soccer and they have that element of the subtextual competition?
Thank you, Alan. It's a beautiful thing. I think Mexicans from North, Central, and Southern Mexico are really proud of the our ancestral heritage that has been inherited from the Aztecs, the Mayans, and they definitely, Mexicans definitely take a lot of pride in el juego de pelota, which is the game that the Mayans played hundreds and thousands of years ago. That was a very central part of their culture. It was a sacrifice game. It was a game where, you know, teams played to the death, and it was something that they took a lot of honor. So I think Mexicans definitely are really aware that that game is belongs here, and it started here a really long time ago. So I think that perspective is there. And I think Claudia Sheinbaum mentioned it when the back in the lottery, when the teams were drawn up back in December, she did mention that el juego de pelota estaba aquí desde tiempo ancestral, that the ball game was here from time immemorial, time ancestral. So it goes all the way from the present to the people, that we feel very connected to our past, and we feel a sense of ownership that the game that we call football, we call soccer, it had some of its roots started here in Mexico. So yes.
Thank you. Great question. May that tradition be heightened, and may the country with the older tradition win that match.
Absolutely.
El fútbol vuelve la casa.
That's right. Well, I mean, you see that slogan everywhere.
I mean, look with Senegal and Ecuador in the mix of third place teams that are advancing. Now, Mexico at home I would not want to be the third place team that draws Mexico at home. But I think England's got to beware other teams that have to face these third place teams that have won their group. I would not want to face Ecuador in a one-off match, man. They're the best defensive team. I mean, you know, they rank as the top defensive team in the world. And when you get to knockouts as opposed to group stages, that's something, you know.
It's a completely different game. Yeah, I think the sense is that, well, two things about the Ecuadorian team is that at least maybe a third of them have either played in Mexico in the Liga MX or have played there very recently. So they know Mexican-style football really well. They know the conditions to play at Azteca really well. I think the sense is like, we don't want to play another Latin American team just out of, you know, because we know each other too well, partly, but also because of the Latin American unity. We'd rather play either with Senegal or Cape Verde, you know, someone like a team like that, just because of, you know, I go back to 2002 when Mexico and the U.S. drew in the round of 16. It's, you think, I know this team very well, but it didn't go too well for Mexico during that World Cup. And I think that's the feeling, that we'd rather play someone who doesn't know us and we may not know too well. So, but if it ends up being Ecuador, then that's what it'll be, but rather play any other third place team.
Yeah. But hey man, you know, I got to say England and the selection, some of the controversial selections that Tuchel have made, one of the things about them is they're some of the older players he's kept on the side, and they're more likely to be winded by the altitude than 20, 22, 23, 25-year-olds who he famously left off the squad. So, and of course, sure that this England team is as cohesive as the Mexican team, which seems brilliantly cohesive. So that could be something else, man. Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as you mentioned, you know, Estadio Azteca, I might be wrong on this as well, but I think Mexico has only lost one official game at Estadio Azteca in over 50, 60 years. So it definitely is going to be our advantage to get into round of 16 and into the round of the quarterfinals. So, and yeah, people, like I said, people are excited. People are starting to believe, and it's really magical and to see it. And like I said, here in Mexico, just being in the city, and we're staying kind of in a, what you would call like in a bougie neighborhood in Roma Norte. But even like I said, it's from the working class folks, the middle class, even the higher upper class people, everybody's excited with their jerseys and talking about it. So it's just a really beautiful thing to see the whole country come together like this.
That's so awesome. Yeah, I mean, it looks like it's shaping up to be a really, really, really great story for Mexico, which, you know, along with France, you know, has been undefeated so far and, you know, really looks the best. What other teams do you see as looking great going into the round of 32 and possibly the round of 16?
Ooh, it's a good question. As you know, Melissa and Alan, you know, I am a in the closet Netherlands fan. So I definitely see the Dutch going straight through the quarterfinals and even, you know, making a run for the final.
They have the toughest opponent of anybody as Morocco has the toughest opponent in the round of 32 that I've seen so far. That could be a final, Morocco versus Netherlands.
Yeah. could be an amazing game. And yeah, it's surprising that we're getting such a heavyweight match so early in the round of 32. But yeah, and you know, Morocco and Brazil a few weeks ago was amazing. I think this game between Morocco and Netherlands will also be an amazing match and will be the highlight of the round of 32. But I do think the Dutch will go far. I think they're playing wonderful. Ronald Koeman is doing an amazing job putting everybody in line. So I see them going far. One thing that's surprising, I guess, on the opposite side is just, well, they did well yesterday, but Belgium had just their struggles in the first round. But I think they're going to pick it up also moving into the knockout round as well.
Well, with them, you know, the rate at which they score goals with Lukaku on the field versus when he's not on the field. I know he's not in shape to start, so it's going to have to be what it is.
So, exactly.
Brazil-Japan is also looking out to be a really good match as well. I think that's going to be a fun matchup. I think we might see some surprises there.
Oh, I think the Moroccans and the Japanese are getting screwed. But I think Japan, yeah, they could take Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, you heard it here from Alan.
Give them a run for their money.
Well, you know, said Angelotti's their secret weapon, right? He's such a great in-game tournament manager, you know. And he really seems to be getting the best out of Vinny Jr., who's, you know, he can't be left off of a player of the tournament list so far.
Yeah. Yep. I'm hoping Neymar will go from the start in this game against Japan. It'll be an amazing thing to watch as well. He seemed pretty fit a few days ago when they played. So hopefully he'll go from the start and we'll be able to see him one more time.
Yep. Yeah, by the way, per Japan and Morocco, look, there are certain things I don't understand. For instance, I haven't gone through and followed the math because it keeps shifting. Obviously, Iran now is the team on the bubble. They need one team to drop below them and they qualify for the third round. And I think it's fair to say all three of us are hoping that they get through. I expect Austria to try to take on Algeria by the time this airs. Of course, this will have happened because I think that's in this particular Austrian team's DNA. And if Algeria loses or Austria loses because they're going for it, then Iran goes through. But a tie, it's one of these situations where a tie ensures both teams going forward. And of course, Austria played in the worst game in World Cup history, achieving a tie by passing the ball around the mid circle, you know, back in the day. And that's created these simultaneous final group stage games as a rule. But I also don't really understand FIFA's rules in terms of how they create the groups. I know it was sort of skewed by having three home teams all be in the group number one. So you'd think the top nine FIFA ranked teams, now maybe they were ranked differently when they pulled the pool together, but how a number five and number six end up in the same group, which is where I think Brazil and Morocco sit, that's just unfair to both teams and really to Morocco in particular. And I think the same thing happened to Japan, you know. I mean, obviously the Canada-Switzerland group really stood out as not having a strong side, and the USA side too, that group, but that's because of their home teams. But yeah, it seems, I don't understand FIFA's how they produced the group, the groups that they group together. It's supposed to be from bucket number one, two, three, and four, and they're ranked accordingly. But that clearly isn't the case.
Well,
or just final thoughts, Fernando.
Thank you all. Yeah, I think, you know, heading into the round of 32, I think we're all pulling for Iran to make it in. I think we're definitely, you know, I'd say partisan in some ways just because of the obstacles that they face. And, you know, just I can't imagine what these Iranian players are going through knowing that their country is being, you know, bombarded as they're, you know, being asked to have really unreasonable accommodations regarding their travel. So definitely rooting for them in that regard just because they're a team that's definitely represented their country really well. So I think that's on everybody's mind for today. So I hope that that's the case. And, you know, we get to see Iran play one more time in the round of 32. And, looking forward to the round of 32 starting tomorrow, and things will definitely start getting really exciting.
Oh, speaking of Iran, I just want to mention in yesterday's game against Egypt how much they were so robbed, absolutely robbed of that goal. And then just in those last 5 minutes in that extra time, how much they just kept going at the goal and kept going and kept going. You know, I know there's an MOU joke in there somewhere, but you know, their persistence, even after getting totally robbed by that VAR call, was just astounding.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that played out, I will really be unhappy if the way it plays out is that they don't go through to the round of 32. And I thought they'd been fantastic. Of course, they drew all their games. Famously, a few years ago, you know, New Zealand received all this global praise for being the only undefeated team in the tournament that year, because I think whoever won must have had a loss at some point. Yeah, I think that was the year Spain won, and they remember they lost their opening game against Switzerland. So the only undefeated team was New Zealand. If they are eliminated, let's hope they are heralded across the world for that fact, but let's hope they go forward and get through to the round of 32. I just have to ask with one final question here, Fernando, so maybe you can provide even more texture. I've never been in a country that's hosting a World Cup that's a real soccer country because, sorry, United States, you're not there yet. It's true that the diasporic communities here are responding to the tournament spectacularly. And yeah, there's probably more enthusiasm for Team USA, which I personally don't share right now. By the way, I'm really weirded out by Mauricio Pochettino's Kim Jong-un style clothing, whatever that's about. But I know he's a good coach and they're a good team and all, but you know, geopolitically, I just can't get all patriotic for them right now. I'm sorry, People's Games fans, I'm saying this. But I was in Italy once when the World Cup started. And the response of the Italians to, and I had to leave Italy shortly after the first game, but even just the first game, every single town, when they won, they people poured out into the street, they brought soccer balls, and whatever the central square was in the city, they start kicking the balls around. It's just absolute euphoria. I can only imagine what the cities with the games are like right now in Mexico. So again, just one last time, provide a sense of just the texture and the, I mean, you know, is it like Mardi Gras times 10? You know, I mean, except without the sloppy drunkenness, you know.
Well, there's a lot of sloppy drunkenness for sure, but it definitely feels like Mardi Gras times 100. And yeah, as I mentioned, you know, the people take the day off, you know, that day leading up to the game, and the games are at 7 p.m. So it's the kind of thing where it's a bank holiday. You go to work if you want to go to work only. You go to school if you want to go to school. It's a holiday, and people just kind of enjoy themselves for the day, get ready for the match, go do some shopping. But yeah, as I mentioned, it's an all out party. And I think, you know, I forget which book that I read a few years ago, but as to why countries host the World Cup. And it's not because it's going to be an economic boost, and it's not because it's going to be, you know, you're going to win the World Cup itself. You do it because it makes you happy and it makes your country happy. I'll have to cite the book where I read that, but it's definitely, that's the feeling here, that people are really excited. And, you know, as many people know, Mexico has been going through really tough times the last few years and decades. So it's really good to see this happening. And then, yeah, and I think I read a couple articles that the economic boost is there for Mexico and Mexico City specifically. A lot of foreigners, a lot of folks coming here for the World Cup, not just from Latin America, but from Europe right here, from a lot, as you know, a lot of Koreans and Japanese are here. So definitely that economic boost will be evident in the next few weeks or next few months when the financial reports come out. But yeah, people are happy, and that's why you host the World Cup.
That's so great. You know, I mean, you know, in our previous episode, Gustavo Arellano was talking about in Los Angeles, you know, and how you know, the World Cup is like bringing out this joy in the neighborhoods that have been oppressed by ICE for over a year now, and just bringing that life back into the city. So, you know, it's kind of happening here too.
Well, you know, by 2030, when the World Cup will be hosted in three very, now we have, props to Canada. I'm going to give them props. I really thought once we started bombing Iran, the tournament should have been moved. I didn't expect it would with Infantino, but moved to Mexico and Canada, with Mexico really being the central point in the final in Azteca. I would have wanted that. But Morocco, Spain, and Portugal, they're all worthy hosts as global soccer mad countries. And in 2030, I think we really need to revive the concept we had from a few people's game, so of an international general popular strike, pure carnival across the whole world. And I have to say, again, the evil, conniving man that he is, he pulls stuff off, Infantino. And I actually now like the 48-team expansion. I like more countries. I like Cape Verde being in this. I like that Curaçao was in this. And so having 48 countries next time, unless maybe China will qualify, maybe India will qualify, and we'll have a global general strike for the euphoria of carnival and of a carnival of soccer. I think people would want it. So we have to start promoting in advance. And by the way, by that point in my fantasy, Zora Mamdani's president. We've changed, made a singular constitutional thing, ship, so that we can have Mamdani as president. Yeah, Socialist Republic of the United States.
I agree.
There we go. Anyway, love you, Fernando. So great to have you. Hey, we hear you have a little bit of a cold, but we all think it's worth it. We all think it's the most worthy head cold in history, in my opinion. So
absolutely.
Pedialyte, Mexican Pedialyte is the best. It's not so much a cold. It's I've been overdoing it for 2.5 weeks. So, but we're having fun.
That's the best way to get a cold.
That's right.
All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Beneath the Surface, the People's Game installment. And we are thrilled to welcome back Laurent Dubois, one of our favorite guests on the People's Game. Laurent Dubois is the John L. Now III Bicentennial Professor in the History and Principles of Democracy. He has authored 7 books, including award-winning titles, and he is also the author of Soccer Empire, the World Cup, and the Future of France, and also The Language of the Game, How to Understand Soccer. And to our minds here at the People's Game, he's one of the great and most prescient commentators on the global game, on the People's Game, and we are delighted to welcome him back to the People's Game.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be with you again.
Well, you know, obviously, we have had you on successive iterations of the People's Game, and in particular with a focus on the French team. You wrote a brilliant book with a focus, of course, on the elder Thuram. Fantastic book. I recommend anybody read it. And we, of course, want to start off with, what is the current sentiment in French society in terms of embracing the team? And just for listeners out there, this has been an issue. You know, we all tend to think of France as being a progressive place. Well, the National Front has been competing for dominance within its politics for years. It's an explicitly anti-immigrant political formation, very reactionary and quite powerful in French society, now with a better chance of winning political power in the next round of national elections. So how has the response to this team been in terms of all of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite interesting, actually, because in many ways, the dialogue around the French team has really changed. And it's actually become more and more rare for far-right politicians to attack the French team, even though the French team today actually has more players, primarily of kind of African immigrant background, African, some North African, some Caribbean still, than ever before. And I think that something, though, has shifted and began to shift in 2018 around the ways in which the team kind of reflects French society. Another way I would put it is that it would actually really sound strange to say Kylian Mbappe is not really French. Like, most French people would just find that sort of absurd. You know, he's on every billboard. He's, you know, he's kind of one, you know, along with a few musicians who are also of African descent, like the most famous French person in the world by far, you know. And and we had a discussion right before the France-Senegal game in Paris with a number of scholars around this. And one of the things that Mabula Soumahoro, who was on that panel, who's a writer who writes a lot about race in France, and others sort of said, was that in the last round of elections, you had these black mayors get elected in a number of different places. And it's almost like they've shifted from, they no longer attack the team, which has become kind of a losing strategy. But there was very virulent attacks against these new black political figures along some of the same lines, you know. One of whom, actually, Bali Bakayoko, who is actually a former footballer, interestingly. So there's also a connection there. In terms of the team itself, you know, there's a way in which I think, and actually the PSG Champions League victory has played this as well. So the Paris Saint-Germain, as a kind of reflection of Parisian society, has just, I would say to some extent, a victory has been won where the cultural valence of that team as being really French, although representing a different kind of France than many on the far right would want, is just so powerful. And it's powerful in partly because it's economically powerful, right? It's also just like part of the commercial culture. You know, you go into a French supermarket and Dembele and Mbappe are everywhere. You know, they're kind of ever present. They're selling stuff. And I think their prominence in kind of global professional football obviously plays a role in that. So I've been interested in that sense, which is not at all to say that correlates with a vanishing racism in France or a decline really in the power of the National Front. But it is also true that the National Front increasingly is trying to position itself, in fact, reaching out to immigrant communities, you know, as happens with the right in the United States as well. So I think that there's, when I wrote my book, it was published in 2010, but it was really about 1998 and 2006. One little piece I'd add to the conversation that I think is interesting because it gets a little bit forgotten is that in 2010, and, you know, I was on the show a bunch of times during that World Cup, the South Africa World Cup, that was a really bad year for the French team. There was actually, I'm quoting her again, but Mabula Soumahoro in the conversation we had said, you know, people say the team isn't French, but what did they do in 2010? They went on strike. And that, for me, is the ultimate proof that they are so French. You know, what other football team goes on strike? Mm-hmm. Only the French team would think of that. So, but nevertheless, a piece of that is quite important to remember is that in the wake of that World Cup, there was at the French Football Federation a set of conversations, secret conversations initially, but that were then leaked to the press, about actually limiting how many Black and North African recruits were brought into the French system, right? And the discussion was around actually by nationality, right? It was around the idea that, according to the people in this conversation, there are all these people who are getting trained in the French system, and then they were playing for other countries, right? And so there's this discussion that starts there about like, oh, we really need to clamp down on this, and maybe we should even have quotas and fewer players. And the coach at the time, Laurent Blanc, and the leader of youth development all were involved in this conversation. But there was a whistleblower at the French Football Federation who specialized in kind of recruitment from the project areas, who eventually released these conversations to the public. As a result, there was kind of a house cleaning. Blanc was removed as coach. This other guy also left. And in some ways, I sometimes think of the guy who made that, the whistleblower, as like the MVP of the French national team, you know, because if you think about, had those people been in power, you know, would 2018 have happened? Would Kylian Mbappe have been on the team? Would Paul Pogba have been the captain? All this stuff. And what is a nice little, a funny little twist about that is that at the time that was happening, some journalists went to Bondy, which is one of the suburbs of Paris, and they interviewed a bunch of little kids who were playing soccer about what they thought about this. And one of them who they interviewed was Kylian Mbappe. Wow. It so happens. Mm. And Mbappe sort of smilingly says, well, other than Cantona and Platini, all the great French players have been Black and Arab. And then he just kind of smiles and he runs away. You know, and it's kind of amazing because you're like, did he know that he was? Anyway, long story short, the point is that there really could have been other directions, but that under Didier Deschamps, and I think in the wake of that, and Deschamps says very publicly, he says like, oh, the team just reflects the way France is, you know, our nation is formed of many different backgrounds, including people who come from former colonies, and I just choose the best players. And, you know, so anyway, so I think it's interesting. So I guess long way of saying, I think the political valence has shifted. Mm-hmm. What is interesting to see always is what athletes do with their status. You know, Mbappe has actually become bolder in his criticism of the far right. So a few years ago, he kind of said that he was against extremes, which could be taken as either far right or far left, or, you know, this time he's really clear. He's been really clear. Like he says, like, if these people are elected, you know, it'll be bad, including for people like me, you know, and he said it more directly. So I think Mbappe's kind of come into, you know, part of the tradition in a sense of footballers from Thuram on in a more full-throated way. You know, the last thing I'll say is that a lot of these players are also Muslim, and their Islam is not something they talk about a ton, but it's present. It's there. And the way that they occupy those identities as kind of African and French and Muslim and all those things in a sort of very comfortable way, I think is really striking. And, you know, so Dembele is another example. The last point I'll make about this World Cup is that we've also reached the kind of summit of, you know, what those people were worried about in 2010, which is that you've probably read the statistic, but there's something like 98, 99 French-born players at the World Cup, like almost 10% of the players of the World Cup are French-born. They're the majority of the Haitian team. They're on the Congo team. They're on the Senegalese team. So in some ways, this World Cup is, you could see it as an incredible recognition of the power of the French system at producing incredibly high quality footballers, right? Yeah. Who are then recruited by teams from all over the world. And that is, I think, really interesting and something to worth thinking about. And for now, I've seen that discussion. And I don't think, instead of being a negative, it's almost like people are saying like, wow, we really, look at what we're producing. We're producing these incredibly talented footballers. And people are making the point that it actually brings a lot of money into France, because if you just calculate the transfer fees coming into French teams that have developed these players, et cetera. So it's interesting to think of this as not a negative thing at all, but actually a positive reflection.
And I have to say this before I throw them out, and you have the best basketball player in the world too.
Also, it's true. So the basketball, yeah, I really find, and even the Olympics, you know, the Olympics team, like the judo team at the Olympics, which was mostly kids from the ball. You know, now there's an interesting question about, well, what are the structures? And I think I wrote a piece that was about the Haitian team and emphasized the fact that the Haitian team, the Haitian diaspora in the US is vastly larger than the Haitian diaspora in France. It's like 10 times larger. So it's over 1 million in the US, about 100,000 in France. Nevertheless, at least 12 of the players on the Haitian team were French born. Wow. And really, it's the French infrastructure that those players who've made Haiti such a strong team have come out of. There's very few from the U.S., which is telling about the sort of structures of opportunity that a Haitian migrant is going to have in those two societies, given, the demographics.
Yeah, it makes sense, too, because, I mean, you play against the best young players, you play against the best professional level players. It's going to be reflected in how the quality of your national team, and that's apparently reflected in Haiti. Amel,
It's really interesting. Last week we had on Ryan McKnight from the UK, who was talking about how neoliberalism and the kind of globalization of the game has in many ways kind of brought some of that element in. And you know, he took kind of this, like, where the localism has kind of diluted. And it's kind of interesting because what you're saying is that the far right politics in France is kind of doing a little bit of the opposite. You know, I'm thinking about Kristen Ross's work and the kind of construction of French citizenship and how, you know, 1998 and 2006, it wasn't so much of an issue as it is now. So I'm wondering if you're seeing any kind of shifts in that arc in terms of how people are talking about citizenship and talking about it, you know, specifically in this instance, you know, not just the debate around Mbappe, but also the debate around Boadi as well. And if you want to say a little bit about that.
Yeah, I do think it's almost like the terrain has shifted in a certain way. I mean, to some extent, it's that at this point, it's become clear that you're going to just have a multi-ethnic France, like the body of citizens of France is and will be henceforth that, right? Now, one can, in that context, have debates about how migration control should be exercised today, how many new migrants should be brought in. I mean, and of course, also around the cultural politics, right? Like those people, to what extent are they expected to perform their Frenchness in certain kinds of ways? And then, of course, you also have like a very real socio-political situation of great deal of exclusion that is racialized, even if it's, you know, even if it's a country in which officially race is not, you know, is not officially recognized, et cetera. But it's very clear that groups of people are having very difficulty accessing the forms of social mobility through education and others. It's a kind of racialized landscape, right? So then you have these kind of panics that regularly are brought up around, like, especially women wearing the hijab, reminder that France still bans French footballers, women from playing in hijab. You know, one of, I think France and Quebec are the last places that do that, right? So you still have that kind of policing around kind of women's bodies and public space and sport that Shireen Ahmed and others have kind of continued reporting on, you know, a lot. And I think in the men's space, again, that kind of question of like, what does being a French citizen look like? And I think what's interesting is that that's played out, of course, it's played out in the political realm, but it's really a battle in the cultural sphere on some level, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it came out during the Olympics, the kind of opening of the Olympics, of course, in different ways with the performers. It comes in. But what's happening, of course, is just a tension between people who want to craft a certain very limited sense of French identity and citizenship, and then a cultural sphere in which the dynamic spaces of French culture are coming out of the popular music sectors that are very much emergent from, again, this, you know, what you can think of as all the positives of, if you want to think of this in positive terms, a highly cosmopolitan France that has these influences from Africa and the Caribbean and Asia and North Africa, all meeting together and kind of encountering one another.
Which is sort of more of the kind of historical arc of the articulation of French citizenship, is it not? Like, way more than this sort of settler colonialist, like, conception of the U.S. A lot of it had, I mean, at least as I understand it, it's been more about like kind of performing Frenchness. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a great point. That actually from the French Revolution on, the kind of culturalness of French citizenship, right? And the culture of French citizenship has been a battleground, right? And I think it's so in that sense, we've got a continuity. And I also think that, I mean, what I would argue is that actually consistently from really from the 1600s on, if we want to get into the deep history, actually French culture has been constituted through this relationship with the colonial world, you know, with indigenous worlds, with the Haitian Revolution in the 18th century, obviously. So in some ways, I mean, what I would always argue is that the French team is like a great representative of like France as it actually is, right? And has been, right? In a sense.
I was going to ask about the level of state investment in the national soccer program. Much was made of the German state investment following their victory in 2014. Is it comparable? Is it greater than? Is it to what significance is it? Because obviously you've spoken of it and it sounds spectacular and the results are phenomenal. So how is that going with the state investment?
It's really high. So Germany and France, I'm not sure which is more, but I think they're similar and they're certainly the two countries. But when you just look in the investment in sports infrastructure in France, it's phenomenal, right? And it's very high. And what I would say is that what you have is in France, you have a combination of like realities of exclusion, of kind of racialized exclusion, combined with the fact that in those communities where people are in many ways stuck or running up against different forms, you know, educational exclusion, they have much less access to the university system, et cetera. But they also are in the presence of a very egalitarian, free public infrastructure for sports training. Right. And it's not just that the facilities are good, but the human infrastructure is really strong. Right. The types of people who coach Mbappe when he's like 12 are often former professional players. You know, they have jobs with the municipality, which are like good, solid jobs with benefits. You know, it's not, they're not like a dad, you know, who sometimes goes, you see what I'm saying? So the actual training system in France, the public infrastructure of training, not just at Clairefontaine, which is the national academy, but all on the grassroots level, is at a really high level, you know, and that these people have connections with professional teams. So they're getting people into the team academies, you know, and all of that is totally free. And in fact, the academies are basically scholarships, right? Like they have room and board and they continue to do their high school. But so for working class or poor families, like some of that is actually helpful, even if it's also difficult, kids, you know, leave home, et cetera. But so it's a really different thing. And I think that's why it's not just that there's like almost 100 French players at the World Cup. There's almost 100 kids who grew up on the outskirts of Paris playing in the World Cup. Like, and then also Lyon and Marseille. But like most of them, it's a very specific like world, you know. And again, it's those communities where it athletics does feel like maybe the only way for social mobility. But then you really do have a really strong infrastructure that's really good at training. And again, like the Haitian players, a lot of those players at one point or another, they played for the various national youth French teams. And it's also true that in the professionals game, teams know that those French trained players just have a really high level of training and professionalism, you know, and that's just all about who they've been trained by and where, you know. So and I think you can see that now. Holland is the second largest group of players at the World Cup. There's like 60. And so the Dutch, in some ways this is the World Cup of like of European like socialist democracies in Europe and their effective state investment in sports and how it's paid off. Like that's kind of partly what's, and that reality is present through all of these teams that represent the whole world.
But you figure, does DRC must have a bunch of Belgian
support. Belgian and French. There's actually a bunch of French players on that team as well. And when I say French, I mean, they're also Congolese, right? They're double nationality, both. Sure. But I mean, the thing is that the US is like this in ways that people don't fully recognize, right? Like Tillman is now, it's the Tillman is, you know, German. Dest is totally Dutch, like just grew up in Holland. And my favorite example is Folarin Balogun, who, as you know, is like, it's just American birthright citizenship is the reason that he, Nico Contour the other day was like an Instagram. And he's like, because of this one accident of history and birthright citizenship, America may finally win the World Cup because we have like a real striker, you know, but Balogun was, know the story, but
huge upside.
But yeah, he grew up in London, Arsenal Training Academy, top of the line, you know, he's always had the, anyway, so I think the thing is that you put that in contrast to the kind of violence and the exclusion of the World Cup, right? Where certain communities are like, do not have access. And when you look at the stadiums, when the African teams are playing, you can really see the effect of those policies, right? Like there's obviously diaspora communities are really coming out in force. Some Haitians came out in force, but people from Haiti could not come. People from the DRC could not come. People from the Ivory Coast could not come. People from Senegal could not come. And I think all that's affected teams. You know, they're not playing with the same, they're playing with really what normally would have been, you know, in a Senegal-Norway game, you would have had, if people had gotten visas, a pretty intense pro-Senegal crowd along, you know what I mean? And you didn't have that. You had like parts of the Senegalese diaspora there. They didn't let the actual core fans from Senegal come, you know, the ones who wear the Senegal thing. Like, so I think that's all very serious, you know, and needs to be taken into consideration. So the African teams are, I don't think it's too much to say that creates a disadvantage, you know, that I think the fans in the stands, the African teams are like playing away games in a competition where they shouldn't be playing away games. They should be playing least 50-50 games or whatever, you know? And so I think that's something to keep in mind, that the European fans are coming in numbers, and African, or especially it's affecting African and Haiti in particular, and just the general forms of exclusion around the World Cup. That's why, I mean, there's like such a contradiction, because it's really, I would say the main theme of this World Cup is like diaspora and immigration on
Sure.
the pitch.
True.
And in some ways in the infrastructure of this, of the tournament also, diaspora and immigration, but in the other direction. And that's really unique. I mean, I said this the other day, like I would have thought it was going to be difficult for the US to surpass like Qatar and Russia in terms of like having a controversial World Cup. And yet it's really the first World Cup where people are not welcome, you know? I mean, Russia and Qatar had all kinds of things that you could complain, you should critique. But when the World Cup arrived, people who had tickets in Russia, your ticket was basically gave you a visa, you know?
I think
They
someone
wanted
made the
people.
same point about like Argentina in 78, like even though it was a dictatorship, people from England, they were in the middle of
Well, it's under
yeah.
an author. It's a totally authoritarian dictatorship that hosts in 78, but they didn't limit Mussolini, in 38 also like welcomed people and also made all public transportation free during the tournament, just as an example. So
Not $150 per trip.
quite the opposite,
Yeah,
actually.
exactly. So I think that is, and that's setting a new kind of precedent, in a certain way. And I think it's striking. And actually, people, even Canada has also been restrictive in this way, in ways that gets a little less press, but I think only Mexico was actually really open, and you could see that actually. I think that like the Congo game in Mexico was one that a lot more people could go to than the ones in the United States. So, and then of course you have the situation of the Iranian team having to like commute from Tijuana, and like, so it's a difficult World Cup to think about, because I think on the one hand, I mean, it's very exciting to see like Cape Verde qualify. I'm really psyched that Senegal qualified. Like, there's beautiful stuff happening, and around the world, communities are mobilizing and watching the World Cup as they always do. And then I think what's important not to lose sight at the same time of all the problems and the forms of exclusion, both financially and otherwise, that are shaping the stadium experience in the United States.
In our last few minutes, I have a couple questions about, first of all, the sentiment around Haiti. That last game, I think it was in Atlanta, so there was like a little bit of a bigger diaspora crowd there. And of course, that second goal, I think a big contender for goal of the tournament, which was absolutely spectacular. And then also your thoughts on the Morocco team, which broke out last World Cup. And a really great fairy tale run. It looks like they might have a shot at doing it again. I mean, certainly the Netherlands Morocco game coming up in the round of 32 is going to be spectacular. So just your thoughts on those two teams and any of the Francophone teams that you think are of note.
Well, thank you. I mean, the Haitian story, I think, was obviously one of the more compelling ones of this World Cup. Their qualification after 52 years, under incredibly difficult conditions, not being able to practice in Haiti, not being able to play in Haiti. So I think that, while in some ways it was like a disappointing series of games, and that Haiti did not win any games or tie any games, they were also an incredibly hard group, right? So the lineup of having to play in particular, Brazil and Morocco, two of the obviously are serious contenders for being one of the top teams. I think they played great. They were ready to be there, and it's a team that has really coalesced, like other teams in the World Cup this year, around a kind of diasporic team. There's only one player who plays in Haiti; the rest are playing abroad, and that's a reflection of just the reality around football itself, but also Haiti itself, which has gone through a lot of crises and people have left the country. And it coalesced. The Haitian diaspora energy around the team was absolutely beautiful, and it was an opportunity for Haitians who are incredibly attacked and vilified. We've seen obviously recently the TPS decision. There's just a long-standing anti-Haitianism in the United States, and so the opportunity for people to coalesce around a team with pride, the symbols of the country, talk about their history. Of course, FIFA did a move that Michel Rolfe Triault would have recognized, in that they forced the Haitian team to take representation of the Battle of Vertières and the Haitian Revolution off their jersey, which had the paradoxical effect of increasing the amount of education people had about the Haitian Revolution, because people were like,
Oh,
learned
yeah.
about that. So
I
anyway,
bought
I
one
think,
immediately.
yeah, exactly right. And I think actually that, Yeah, the jersey makers are selling a lot more thanks to that. So there's a way in which, yeah, it's a real success story, even if they did not make it out of the group phase, in terms of the soccer providing an opportunity for a powerful gesture of solidarity and identity around the team. And I think that the Haitian team is going to be great and competing in Gold Cups to come, hopefully in future World Cups, et cetera. So I think that's going to remain one of the most powerful stories from this World Cup, even if it would have been great for them to advance. You asked about some of the other teams. So Senegal for me is
Senegal, Morocco. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the Morocco team, from the African side, of course, the Morocco team comes into this World Cup with a certain kind of pall around the African Cup of Nations story, you know? There's an interesting sort of set of things around the Morocco team, that make it, I think, a little like, in 2022, I think it really unified people in a way that now it's a little bit more, the sort of African fans have a kind of more complicated relationship with Morocco maybe than they might have before. And especially, of course, there's other African teams competing with it. But I think it's going to, they're obviously going to be strong contenders and a great team. And then Senegal, you know, who a few days ago I was really worried were not going to make it into the next round, just yesterday pulled out this kind of unbelievable performance, you know, scoring 5 goals. It almost seemed like a different team from their earlier games. And so now I think there's a ton of energy around that, especially since it feels like it was kind of a last minute, last gasp, you know, access to the next round as well. So they're a team to watch too.
Senegal, by the way, is my team in this tournament. I mean, for the somewhat petty reason that they have 2 prominent Evertonians and I'm an Everton fan. I was very excited about them winning the African Cup of Nations. And if you could actually just explain to our audience what happened there between Morocco and Senegal in that game. We've made reference to it on a few shows, and I think maybe as somebody who's has access to you know, for the French press, there's not a lot of coverage of the African Cup of Nations in the English language press. And obviously, what happened there is at one point Senegal pulled its players. What's your understanding of how that's playing out in the courts and your interpretation of the event specifically? And I still have 2 questions after this.
Yeah, I mean, to my mind, that African Cup of Nations final this past year was maybe one of the most fascinating and interesting games of soccer like ever. Mm-hmm. And it's partly because the Senegalese team went into that game already with a sense of certain level of injustice. Morocco had severely limited the number of seats for Senegal fans. So in a sort of maybe looking ahead to what we've seen in the World Cup this year, there was kind of a restriction. They only had 6,000 seats for Senegal fans in the final. There had not been sufficient security. There's a bunch of different things. So the Senegalese team went into that game. And then at a certain moment, just felt like there was an injustice in terms of the calls and the same sort of thing where a VAR review was not done on something that it should have been done on. And then a penalty was given to the Moroccan team. And Senegalese team and Senegalese people who are very chill on the whole, it took a lot to get to get them there, but they actually walked off the pitch. Right. And eventually Sadio Mane, who's the captain of the team, and there's great stories around this, but he actually spoke to one of the elders from the 2002 World Cup team when Senegal had defeated France in the 2002 World Cup. And those players are kind of legendary and kind of mentors for this team. And one of them was there and basically told Mane, like, you have to go in and get the players to come back out. Like, we can't. And then later came out that when he went in, among other things, Mendy, who is the extraordinary Senegal goalkeeper, said, hey, don't worry. I'm going to stop the penalty kick.
Yeah, and he did.
Which is exactly what happened. And Brahim Diaz made this Panenka, which was meant to humiliate Mendy, but instead humiliated himself. And then Senegal went on to win the game. But subsequently, Morocco complained and brought up charges against the Senegal team. Also, a number of Senegalese fans were actually imprisoned in Morocco for 6 months. Put in prison because of like altercations with security, but very severe, you know. So there was a bunch of Senegalese fans who were in prison in Morocco and only recently came home. And Morocco won the case in CAF. And so formally now they won the African Cup of Nations. The Senegalese don't believe that, you know, will not accept that.
But I think they're challenging in court, right?
They're challenging it now. They have kept their medals.
Yes, that's my understanding too. Yeah,
the Senegalese president actually often gives his addresses with the the trophy behind him in the presidential office. And in addition, numerous Senegalese metal workers have made like replicas of the trophy so that they're, if anyone ever tries to come get it. So I think a lot of people in Senegal and in elsewhere in Africa feel like Morocco, in a sense, you know, should have just left that alone. Like, and that they're sort of, they now technically won that game 3-0, you know, but no one. So I think, yeah.
I remember watching it and feeling like the Senegalese had the balance of play too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think Senegal deserved to win that. And it is true that they walked off most of them walked off for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And you know, you can ask questions about that. But so anyway, I think that in African football, that has been the story of the year, you know, and it's really animated. And there's a sense that too, that Morocco, you know, which is going to be co-hosting the World Cup in 2030, is sort of very in with FIFA and Infantino, et cetera. So, you know, these things change and shift quickly. You know, it doesn't take away from the power of many of the Moroccan players and their style of play, et cetera. But it's just for those who are not aware of that, that's coming into this the way that, in the same way that people may have followed that, like there's a huge turn among many African fans against South Africa, which is also paradoxical for many people, but it's because there's this really huge rise in xenophobia in South Africa against African migrants from other parts of the continent. A real violent, you know, kind of a version of what we're seeing in Europe or North America. And so that has led to many people sort of rooting against South Africa, even, you know, other Africans rooting against South Africa. But I think, you know, teams like Haiti and Senegal, I mean, all these teams are bringing really joyous, great football to the pitch. And, you know, obviously people are needing that right now. We all need that. And, you know, the Kansas City love for Algeria is a beautiful thing. You know, there's good stuff happening, you know, and it's providing an opportunity for people to offer an alternative vision of how people should relate. So I think that is true. And you know, we have to somehow combine understanding all that with a relentless critique of FIFA and all that they've done, and you know the many evils of this tournament as well. It's also been fun watching everybody make fun of Alexi Lalas, but that's
it's rough, a small
pleasure.
I'm so glad that all I have is Peacock, because all I'm watching is Telemundo. I don't have to listen to Alexi this time at all.
Yeah, I in some ways, like, to some, one of the reasons I had to just leave the country for the World Cup was to so I didn't have to. I can just listen to the French commentators who are fine, you know, who are Italian now. So,
Look, it's great talking. There's a million things I'd love to catch up with you again as we go forward in this tournament. A million questions.
Yeah, I'd love to talk again if you'd like to. If you want to have me on, I'm always happy to discuss. We always have great conversations. So,
thank you so much, and enjoy Italy, and enjoy the games, which are kicking off right now.
2 minutes ago. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. There we go. Thank you.
Good night, guys.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
And with that, thank you very much for listening to The People's Game. We'll be back next Friday at 5 p.m.
right here on KPFK. And what are those social media tags where people can follow The People's Game, Mel?
So we are at peoples.game at Instagram, peoples_game on X or Twitter, Game Project on Blue Sky. And you can catch our podcast wherever you get your podcasts, at The People's Game.
Thank you so much, Mel. Talk to everyone soon.
Many people make KPFK's programs possible, each giving what they can to help ensure the station's future. One way to help is by donating land or other property that you no longer need. Learn more about the advantages to KPFK and to you of donating real estate at kpfk.org.
Great. Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.
This is April Grace, and you and I are listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 93.7 FM in San Diego, and 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake. Also streaming online at